We live in an inspiringly changing world. And when you look at medicine and science in general, as it continues to advance at such a rapid pace, it's just astounding. If you take a step back and you realize the Nisim Gluyim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the incredible miracles and the life-saving procedures that can be done today to take care of people who are in need, is something that is really, really phenomenal. And it's something we should be so grateful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for. So as we know, one of the very dynamic procedures that we have the ability to do today is to harvest organs from a cadaver and then transplant them into a living recipient. So this week, Bechasdei Hashem, someone I am close with, was blessed to receive this gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu and was able to have a surgery that was so life-altering. And we're so grateful to the Ribbono Shel Olam that it was successful. And that so far, so good. And ko yitain Hashem v'ko yosif. We hope that it will continue. There's always a risk of rejection. And that's something that obviously one always has to be on the lookout for. But it may be go back and ask the very obvious and basic questions when you talk about the whole notion of organ harvesting in the first place. So we need to really get over three obstacles, three potential isurim, either d'oraisa or d'rabbanan, when we talk about this whole idea of harvesting an organ and transplanting it into another living recipient. Question number one is the whole prohibition that we have of nivul of hana miguf hames. One is not allowed to have benefit from a dead body. That is question number one. Question number two is the isser of nivul and bizayon hames. I'm not allowed to defile and desecrate a body. Forget about the isser hana. I'm not allowed to do anything that defiles the body itself. And number three, we have a mitzvah saseh, we have a positive commandment of kvura. We have to bury someone after they pass away. So what right do I have to delay a burial, even if I have the most noble of intentions? But who said that that would be permissible for the sake of harvesting an organ? All three of these questions are very, very important questions. Now, although they are all important, it is quite obvious that when we're dealing with a chole sheyesh bo sakana, if we're dealing with someone whose life is actually in danger, so let's say you need somebody who needs a heart transplant, or you have somebody who needs a something that really puts their life in danger if they do not have it, obviously that would be permissible. And even though you have all three of these obstacles, they are not obstacles when you're talking about saving somebody's life. As the Gemara says, "Ein davar ha'omed b'fnei pikuach nefesh," there is nothing that is more critical, that is more important than pikuach nefesh, than saving a life, and therefore we would basically override any of the prohibitions of the Torah, except for a few very notable exceptions. We would override anything in order to save a life. So leaving that case aside, what we're talking about here is a chole she'ein bo sakana. We're talking about a chole whose life is not in danger if they don't have this. Let's say, for example, a cornea transplant. So is the person's life in danger? Now, somebody will argue if they don't have the eyesight that they're supposed to have, their life is in danger because they can trip more easily, they can bump into something, they can get into trouble. I'm not talking about that. But a summa, somebody who's dead. Yeah, so the Gemara says a summa, what?
A blind person.
Yeah.
Isn't a summa like a dead person?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. Isn't a summa like a mace? And in general, so let's take that a little further. So if you have somebody who goes blind, do they have a right to commit suicide? I'm dead anyway. Right? I'm asking that. So obviously the answer to that is no. Why not? So the Gemara means that summa chashav kemeis means there's something very impaired about the life that they're going to live moving forward. It's not to be taken literally in a halachic construct to say summa chashav kemeis, and therefore we're allowed to do certain things. Summa is definitely a devastating thing for a person to be able to have to handle and deal with and move forward with, especially when they had the ability to see before. I don't know how many people in the room are friendly or familiar with Lavi Greenspan, who is an absolute amazing personality. I remember Lavi Greenspan when he was in YU. He was a Talmud of my father, and I just, you know, unfortunately he went through a terrible, terrible illness, and he went blind. And Baruch Hashem, he was able to have smicha, and he went through law school, even though he was blind. He has a tremendous amount of stamina and an unbelievable amount of emunah. And Lavi Greenspan, Bali Ayin Hara, got married this past Sunday. And it was a tremendous, tremendous simcha. I think my father was the Masada Kedushin. And my father told me, I asked him, how was the wedding? The only thing he said was, obviously it was amazing, but the only thing he shared with me, the detail, was that Lavi walked down to Esa Einai El Haharim, which made everybody cry. But anyway, so Yes, asuma is chashav kemeis, and there is something definitely deficient about a person who is unable to see, and the quality of life is not going to be the same at all, but that would not allow us to do everything. We wouldn't say that chashav kemeis is taken in a literal sense in that regard. So when we're talking about someone who's a chola she'ein bo sakana, for example, somebody who needs a cornea transplant, or another example, nowadays, I guess I would say a kidney transplant is probably more chola she'eish bo sakana, because if they don't have the transplant, they'll probably have to be on dialysis, and ultimately they will die much younger. So that would be categorically a chola she'eish bo sakana. But let's say, for example, you have nowadays a uterine transplant, where you have a woman who had to have a hysterectomy, or a woman who is born with a certain condition where she is born without a uterus and then has the opportunity to have a uterus donated by someone else and then transplanted in. Would that be permissible? She can live out her whole life without it. It won't be the same quality of life. She won't be able to have children of her own because she doesn't have a uterus to carry a child on her own. But she can be perfectly healthy and normal and fine and functioning without this. So what would be the heter? And who said there is one? So let's discuss it. I think it's a very interesting question. One cannot speak about the whole topic of cadavers and autopsies at all without discussing the very formidable tshuva of the Noda B'Yehuda. The Noda B'Yehuda was the undisputed Gadol HaDor in the 1700s, and he passed away in 1793. I said in the shiur yesterday that to say that the Noda B'Yehuda was the Rav of Altoona, Hamburg, Mainz, and Prague, and all of that is almost an understatement, because he was not limited to that. The tshuvas of the Noda B'Yehuda are ones which really formulate so much of the halachic process as we know it today in so many areas of halacha, and they are so important in any discussion in halacha. So the Noda B'Yehuda here has a very interesting discussion where there was a Maisa She'ira B'London. There was a story that happened in London. And the story was that there was somebody who had Choli Evan B'Kiso, which I think means he had kidney stones. And he was in terrible pain, and they didn't know what it was, and in the end, he passed away. Now, did he pass away from the kidney stones? Doctor, you can tell me, is that something that is a... Does that happen? I'm not sure if he passed away... What?
Not today.
Not today. Okay, so this is in the 1700s. Wasn't clear exactly why he died. He was complaining from a horrific pain that he had somewhere in his abdomen. They didn't know exactly what it was. And the question was, are they able to do an autopsy in order that they should be able to have some kind of information should somebody else come into the hospital with the same kind of pain? And that was a very interesting question. So he wanted to know, for the purpose of medical research, for the purpose of medical understanding, would we be allowed to do that, or perhaps not? So there were those who wanted to say that, and all of this is outlined in the Tshuva of the Noda B'Yehuda, where he says, let's look a few parshios from now, when the Torah discusses in great detail about what happens when Yaakov Avinu dies. And we're told that, Vayachantu Osob in Mitzrayim, we're told that they did something to the body, right? They embalmed the body. Now, how do they do that? Seemingly, presumably, you have to cut open the body and do something. You don't just put all kinds of fragrances around the body. You do something that's intrusive to the body itself. So he says, wouldn't that seem to be an indication that maybe we'd be allowed to do some kind of incision on the body after the demise in order to do something positive? Over there, they were doing something which was a covet on the ace because they were trying to do an enhancement to the body to embalm it. And over here, we're doing something which maybe you can argue is also a kavod ames, because we're using the body for a great purpose. Would that be the same? Or perhaps it would not be. They then bring a tshuva from the Rajba that is quoted in Shulchan Aruch. And the Rajba writes, let's say a person instructs the Chevra Kadisha that they want, that he wants them to put sid al habasar. They want him to put some kind of, sid is a...
Cement,
some kind of plaster on certain parts of the body, in order that there should be equal habasar quicker. After he's buried, he doesn't want to have that the body's going to decompose and rot slowly. It should go much quicker. And the understanding in that day, in the days of the Rajba, was if you put some kind of plaster on top of parts of the body, then the body will decompose sooner. Would we be allowed to listen to such a request, or perhaps not? So all of this is brought into the Tshuva of the Noda B'Yehuda, and he says, how can you compare any of those two? In that case of the embalming of the body by Yaakov Avinu, that was done lichvodo shel hames. That was in order that the mace should have extra kavod, that the body shouldn't decompose. And the same with the tshuva of the Rajba. The reason why the body, why the instruction was that we should do this to the body is because he doesn't want to decompose slowly. That's a bizoyan hames. But in this case, what's the kavod hames involved? So you're saying it's a kavod that my body part should be used for a noble purpose. Is that really considered an objective kavod ames? Is that true? And therefore, he says, perhaps you cannot bring any proof from anything that's discussed. Maybe that wouldn't be the same. Then he quotes a Gemara in Maseches Baba Basra. The Gemara is an interesting case where you have somebody, a child, who inherits his father's estate. And he's trying to be a shrewd businessman. He's trying to figure out, what am I going to do? What would my father have done with his estate? He would have just left it sitting around? Of course not. He would have invested the money here, done a business deal there. So the child is trying to follow in the footsteps of his father. After all, he inherited the money from his own father. He wants to make his father proud. So he sells this humongous estate that he has to somebody else. It turns out he was totally ripped off. He doesn't know what he was doing. And then this child dies. And the other Bnei HaMishpacha come along and they say, we want to take back the deal because we know that our brother was ripped off. And the owner, who now owns it, the buyer, says, but it was a bona fide sale. They argue, no, it wasn't. He was a katan. He was a young child. What does he know? He's 9 years old. He doesn't know anything about business. He's not really somebody who has the ability to sell a piece of property or an estate. So what do we do? They claim he was young. He claims that this person was an adult. He was negotiating with me like an adult. And I believe that he was so very mature, and that's why I went ahead with the deal. I never would have ripped off a young child. Maybe yes, maybe no. This is the debate. And the Gemara says that they came to ask the Tanoim, would we be allowed to open up the grave to see, does his body seem to be like a gadol? Does he have bodily signs that indicate that maybe he is already over the age of bar mitzvah? Would we be allowed to do that or not? The Gemara says, no, that's a bizayon ames. He wouldn't be allowed to do that for the sake of money? Just to get back the money from selling the estate? Absolutely not. Now, how do you interpret the bottom line of that Gemara? Some say it's a bizayon ames to dig up a grave to do anything, and therefore you would not be allowed to do it. Others say it's a bizayon ames to dig up a grave for such a silly thing like money. But if it was for a very noble purpose, for something else that's much greater than money, then of course we would be allowed to do that. So that's the big debate, that's the big dispute, and all of this, with all the deliberation, all the back and forth in the Noda B'Yehuda, trying to figure out what the psak is, he says the following. Yesh safek sakanas nefashos lifanenu. The bottom line that he comes down to is, if we believe that there is a sakanas nefashos lifanenu, which means we have another patient in the hospital who's complaining of the same kind of symptom, and we think that by doing some kind of dissection of this cadaver, we will then gain medical information to help patient B, who's already here in the hospital, he's lifanenu. In such a case, he says, that would be permissible. Aval writes in Yehuda, benidon didan, if you just want to do some kind of theoretical medical research, ein shum chole lifanenu hatzarach lezeh, rak sherotzim lilmod chachmazu, ulai yizdamein chole shiyi hatzarach lezeh, maybe in the future there's going to be a patient that will gain from the research that we do. In such a case, he says, we would not allow bizayon ames for that. That's the bottom line of the Noda B'Yehuda. And he says, if we were going to start allowing this, nobody would ever be buried. Why? Because you can always say, there's a little bit more we can learn. Maybe we're going to pick up something when we dissect the body and we're going to find some information that will help us down the line. And therefore, the Noda B'Yehuda says, absolutely not. Unless you have a situation of a chole lifanenu. Unless you have another patient who's here in the hospital in front of us, that is the only time we would allow it. Now, the Chasam Sofer deals with this as well. And he says, well, we have to ask ourselves, how would one define that category of chole lefanenu? So the Noda B'Yehuda lived at a time where there wasn't so much travel back and forth like we have today. So you had one hospital. Chole lefanenu means, in the vicinity, do we have another person who's complaining of the same symptoms? So does it mean in the same room? The Chasam Sofer asks, does it mean in the same hospital, in the same city, in the same state, in the same country? What are the parameters of this halacha that the Noda B'Yehuda said? So one of the Talmidim of the Chasam Sofer writes that it doesn't mean chole lifanenu manish. It doesn't mean he has to be sitting in the bed right next to this one and we're going to take the information and transfer it over to the other patient. That's not what it means. Rather, he broadens it and he says, v'choli hashchiach lavo lifnei harofim mumchim bi'ir melucha. If you live in a city and you have patients coming in every day with all kinds of different problems, and this is fairly common, and it's fair to assume that somebody may come in with the same kind of symptom in this very city. That is also called a chole lefanenu. That's what the Talmidim of the Chasam Sofer say, because we know that that medical research will be used for another person. However, he says, if you live in a small city where nothing ever happens, you know, once in a while you have an issue, you don't really have a functioning hospital, you have one medical doctor who takes care of the problems when they come up, Then he says that would not be relevant. To then go and do something to that cadaver would have no learning experience at all, and that would be something that we would not allow. Now Rav Moshe raises the issue as well. And Rav Moshe disagrees with the whole premise of the Noda B'Yuda. And he says, I don't think it's true. And he says that in general, he doesn't think this would be allowed. And he voices his objection to the whole premise that the Noda B'Yuda makes, that as long as you have a Cholo L'Faneinu, it would be permissible. He said, who told you that that would be allowed either? So again, this is a major debate, a major discussion. In fact, Rav Moshe has a general discussion, a general tshuva, where he talks about his feelings with regard to organ donation. And this tshuva was actually written to Rav Moshe Scherer, who was the head of the Agudas Yisrael. He wrote it in 1978, so it's a tshuva from quite a while ago, where he writes about his feelings. B'davar shenishal me Washington. You once got a question, he says to Rabbi Scherer, from Washington. Mi lishkas hanasi. What does that mean? President's office. He writes here, office shel ha-president, in Hebrew. So he says, the White House asked you, Rabbi Scherer, what do you think about organ donation? What's the Jewish position? Which made sense. Rabbi Scherer was always dealing with the government officials on behalf of the Jewish community. And the question was, what does the Jewish community feel about organ donation in general? So the question was, if I, obviously, I'm not allowed to take somebody's organs without them consenting to want me to do that, but am I allowed to volunteer my organs because I'm just a nice person? Am I allowed to do that or not? And Rav Moshe writes, Ein adam shum bailim al gufo, litzavo shiyasa begufo. What do I care, says Rav Moshe, that somebody left instructions that they should use my organs? Who said you own your organs? You don't own your body. You don't own your body. As the Radvaz writes very famously in one place, Hanefashos lihena, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, a person's body and soul belong to me, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, not to you. This is why the Gemara says in Baba Kama, Asur la'adam lachbo ba'atzmo. We don't have a right to inflict pain on ourselves. We don't have a right to damage our own bodies or to do something to mutilate our bodies. We're not allowed to do that. Why not? If it's my body, I can do what I want. The answer is, Hanefashos lihena. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, these belong to me and not to you. Which is a major question with regard to cosmetic surgery. Who said a person has a right to do a cosmetic surgery where you're putting yourself in danger? Do you have a right to make that decision or not? The poskim all say it's permissible, depending on what the circumstances are. But again, these are all major questions. So Rav Moshe there discusses that issue. The case that we're talking about, as we mentioned, is not a pikuach nefesh case. We're talking about, as we said, a transplant which is going to enhance the quality of life, but without it, the patient will be able to live a healthy and wonderful life, maybe not the same to the same degree, but it will be something that definitely does not have an absolute necessity for this patient to have. So what are the obstacles? Number one, as we mentioned, there's a mitzvah of kvura. Where does that come from? Pasuk in Sefer Dvarim, where the Torah says, after you administer capital punishment, after somebody is killed by the Beis Din, which is a very unusual circumstance, but we're told that after somebody is killed, the Torah instructs us, lo salin nivlaso al ha'etz. You're not allowed to leave him hanging outside. Kavur tikbureinu b'yomahu. You must bury that individual. Man or woman needs to be buried immediately. Ki kilalas elokim tali. Rashi there writes on Chumash, kilalas elokim tali means when a person looks at somebody who is in a state of disgrace, you say to yourself, hey, you have a resemblance to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You were created b'tzelem elokim, and it's an embarrassment to the Ribono Shel Olam that there is a person that is not being treated with dignity. And therefore, the Gemara says, based on this, the Gemara says in Masechet Sanhedrin, we have an obligation to bury the mesim. Not only when it's a haruge Beis Din, not only when the Beis Din administers capital punishment do we have an obligation to bury, but even any person who passes away, we have an obligation to bury. Now that is a machlokes, whether or not that is a mitzvah midaraisa or only a mitzvah midarabanan. And the Rambam comes to the very clear conclusion that this is a mitzvah midaraisa. We have a biblical obligation to bury all of the dead. And even though, he writes, even though somebody leaves over instructions, shelo yikvaru, for whatever reason, he says, you know, it's too expensive. I don't want to bury a burial plot. Just leave me. Let me decompose and whatever happens, happens. Let the animals figure out what to do with me. Says the Gemara, we would not listen to such an instruction. It's a strange thing for a person to leave over as an instruction to his children. But even so, the Rambam says, if somebody explicitly leaves over instructions, even with the best of intentions, we are not allowed to listen to them because we have a mitzvah of kvura. So much so that the Stechemet even asks, Why don't we make a bracha when we do the mitzvah of kvura? Like, that's how far this goes. We make a bracha when we do everything else. So when we're performing the mitzvah of kvura, why do we not make a bracha? So that is definitely a mitzvah that we have. So in terms of that, we then have to ask ourselves, does that mitzvah of kvura apply equally to a Jew and a non-Jew? Most of the times when you have an organ donation, just based on the statistics here in the United States, it's going to be from a non-Jew. We are the overwhelming minority by a landslide, and therefore most of the organs that are going to come in are certainly going to be from a non-Jew. Do we have a mitzvah of kvura by a non-Jew the same way we have that commandment to bury a Jew? Rashi writes on Chumash that the obligation of kavur tikburenu is only be Yisrael greda. That is only for a Jew. It is not for a non-Jew. Reb Soloveitchik had a very beautiful interpretation why that should be the case. What should be the difference? So that's a very interesting question. We don't have enough time to talk about it. But the Ramban on Chumash writes, well, one second. Is that really true? That you only have a mitzvah to bury a Jew, and you don't have the mitzvah of kvura by a non-Jew? After all, says the Ramban, if you know anything about Tanakh, you look in, you don't even have to know so much of Tanakh. Sefer Yehoshua, the very first Sefer of Nach, so you're told there that Yehoshua, when he killed Malchei Canaan, when he was in battle and he ultimately killed the enemy, so it says that he was makbid, he was careful to make sure to go back and bury all the dead. Why did he bury the dead? They were non-Jews. Yehoshua had nothing better to do. He should have sent the soldiers home. Why was he busy with that? Says the Ramban, doesn't it seem that there's a mitzvah of kvura even for a non-Jew? And the Ramban answers no. The difference there is that that was an Eretz Yisrael. And we have an additional pasuk when it comes to Eretz Yisrael, velo satame esad mascha. That applies whether you're a Jew or a non-Jew. So in Eretz Yisrael, we say, Jew and non-Jew have a mitzvah of kvura. You have to make sure to look after the person to make sure they are buried immediately. When it comes to Chutz La'aretz, and you don't have that additional pasuk of lo satame esad mascha, so then we say there's a distinction between a Jew and a non-Jew, which is why my father has pointed out many times that if you're going to be in medical school in Eretz Yisrael, you have an additional problem that you have to overcome than being in medical school in America. Obviously, in medical school, they have to dissect cadavers all the time. So now they have virtual anatomy, and maybe that relieves the problem. But if you're going to have real anatomy, which I would hope any doctor who's going to be working on me has actually touched a body in their life and not just virtually seen what maybe a body looks like. I don't know. That's just my preference. But be it as it may, if you're going to go to medical school in Chutz La'aretz, okay, so you have kvura. So you'll say it's not a problem with kvura because it's a non-Jewish body and there's no mitzvah of kvura for a non-Jew. However, if you're going to be talking about Eretz Yisrael, where the overwhelming majority of the cadavers are going to be Jewish cadavers, then you have this problem of lo satame asad mascha. And the longer you leave a body not being buried, the more and more you're violating that din of kavur tikburenu bayamahu. So that's obstacle number one. We've gotten over it. Here in the United States, it doesn't seem to be a problem because most of the people that are going to be offering their organs for a organ donation are going to be non-Jews, and there's no prohibition of kavur tikburenu by a non-Jew. Obstacle number two is we have a prohibition of getting benefit from a mace. Can there be a greater benefit than this? You're taking something from a dead body and you're actually using it for every day of your life. Can there be a greater hana than that? And this is a major question. So the Gemara says in Maseches Avodah Zarah, we learn from Gzeira Shava, Sham Shami Miriam, that one is not allowed to derive benefit from a dead body. Okay, Mishnah Melech has a suffix. Is that a Nisa D'Araisa or a Nisa D'Rabbanan? Why should it make a difference? Either way, it's not permissible. Well, we'll see in a minute why it should make a difference. If it's a Nisa D'Rabbanan, it will make a major difference, and that is something to keep in mind. When the Gemara says that there's a Gzeira Shava, that we learn an Isser Hanag, Sham Shami Miriam, is that something that's actually then becomes an Isser D'Araisa? Or is that an only an Isser D'Rabbanan? Obstacle number three is the din of Bizayon V'Nivel Hames. We know the Torah says, Lo sala nivlaso ala etz, as we said, after you administer misas bez, then you're not allowed to allow the body to then decompose. You can't just leave it there in Bizayon. You have to make sure to bury. So much so, the Gemara writes in Sanhedrin a shocking statement. The Gemara says, when you give somebody the punishment of skila, so the halacha is, people think it means you just throw stones on them. It says first, what? First, you push the person off the cliff. If they're still alive, then, if they survive that, then you throw stones on them. So the Gemara says, well, you know, how high should the cliff be? Let's have a little rachmanis on the person. Well, there's a soft line that has to be drawn between, on the one hand, having rachmanis on the person, and as a result of that, we should throw them off from a higher cliff, that they should die right away and not suffer. And on the other hand, if you're going to throw them from too high up, you know what's going to happen underneath. That's a bizayin ameis. So the Gemara says, "V'hafta l'recha kamocha baror lo misa yafe." Even if you're going to have to administer misas beizdin, do it respectfully, do it nicely. Even though the person deserves to be spit on and this person deserves to have every bizayin done to them, but still, the Gemara says this is something that should be done nicely. Again, a major discussion there whether this is an Isser D'Oraisa or only an Isser D'Rabbanan. The Achronim discussed that in great length. So there's a big discussion in the Sefer Nishmas Avram. Nishmas Avram is a beautiful set of Svarim that is written by Dr. Abraham. Dr. Abraham is a great Talmud Chacham who is a very close Talmud of Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And Dr. Abraham very often quotes his discussions that he had with Reb Shlomo Zalman in medicine. So he writes that he had a question. Was he allowed to learn how to do intubation on a patient by doing it on a cadaver? How else is he ever going to try out intubation? You're not going to have anybody volunteer to ever be intubated. Whoever wants to do that? So the only way to learn how to do an intubation is to take a cadaver and learn how to stick a tube down the throat. Otherwise, he's never going to learn. So he asked Reb Shlomo Zalman whether that would be considered a bizayon and nivul hames or perhaps not. And he says, "Kivon shehu davar shehu osim lachola mutar la'asos lames." Says Reb Shlomo Zalman, why would that be a bizayon hames? We would do that to a chola. We would stick a tube down their throat. So why, by doing that to a mace, is that considered a bizayon? Bizayon means you're doing something that is disgraceful. This is not disgraceful. And therefore, that is the question here. How far does that go, the Isra bizayon hames, and how does that play into all of these scenarios here? When we talk about bizayon hames, you have to ask yourself the same question. Does that apply across the board to a Jew and a non-Jew? Or do you say that is only something that is reserved for a Jew? That is a major, major discussion and debate in the Rishonim. Whether this is something that is permissible for a Mesei Akum, or would you say that Mesa Akum does not share the prohibition Mida Araisa as we would find by Mesa Yisrael? Why is that relevant? It's relevant because the Rama writes in Yerideya, Simen Kufnun Hei. And this is a Rama that's not really in the place where it should be. Simen Kufnun Hei has nothing to do with this discussion at all. But my father is very fond of pointing out that the Rama's opinion is that we would allow an Isser D'Rabbanan to be violated for the sake of a Chola She'ein Bo Sakana. For a Chola She'ein Bo Sakana, we would allow an Isser D'Rabbanan to be violated. So therefore, if you believe that Bizayon Hames to a non-Jew is only an Isser D'Rabbanan, and you believe also that the Isser Hanah Min Hames Akum is only an Isser D'Rabbanan, then, when we're talking about a Chola She'ein Bo Sakana, for example, somebody who needs a cornea transplant, somebody who needs a uterine transplant, you would say that would be permissible because they would be a Chola She'ein Bo Sakana. Now, this is a very interesting case. Is that really a Chola She'ein Bo Sakana? Somebody, let's say, who's born with this condition, MRKH it's called, a woman who's born without a uterus, she's not a Chola She'ein Bo Sakana, she's totally healthy, she's fine. She's not a chola at all. And in fact, I was dealing with the following shaila. So there is a couple that is waiting now for a uterine transplant. If you get the call from the hospital that somebody was in a fatal car accident and they have an organ available that matches your blood type and everything else, you have 10 hours to respond whether you want it or they should give it to someone else. And the shaila was, what do they do on Shabbos? So every day of the week, you're on call. You answer the phone. What do you do on Shabbos? So instinctively, you'll say, of course you answer the phone. Not so fast. Why are you allowed to answer the phone? You're not a chola. Why are you allowed to do malacha? Interesting question. I think it's a fascinating question. So Amir La'akum would for sure be permissible. Amir La'akum in general, the Rama says that we allow Amir La'akum b'makom tzorech gadol, b'makom mitzvah derabim, b'makom mitzvah rabbah. So over here, you have the mitzvah puravu. If the woman's not going to answer the call, so then she's not going to have the opportunity to have her own children naturally. So you're taking that away from her. Can you imagine the shalom bias that this is going to cause? Can you imagine how much strife this is going to cause, how much tension it's going to cause between the two, and how depressed this woman is going to be if she's been waiting for this transplant, and now you're going to tell her, sorry, it's Shabbos, you can't answer the phone, and if you miss it, sorry, you missed your chance.
What about driving to the hospital on Shabbos?
So that would be... that would be a mitzvah rabbah, and that would be all other factors. We would allow Amir la'akum. Forget Amir la'akum. What if there's no akum that you can make a deal with? What would you say in such a case? My father was mekel, My father said they'd be allowed to pick up the phone on Shabbos and make phone calls to all the doctors to make sure that the procedure is allowed to go through. Why? What's the justification? My father said, right when I asked him, he said it's pashut, that this would be considered a sakanas aver. There's a category of Hilchos Shabbos, when we talk about a chola b'Shabbos, where we say, if there's a danger to a person's limb, then you're allowed to violate certain Isurim derabanan on Shabbos. Now, that's a big chiddush. It's a chiddush because sakanas aver means, if I don't take care of this, and I don't get the stitches in my finger on Shabbos, then I'm going to lose the use of the finger. So I'd be allowed to violate an Issa derabanan to make sure I don't lose the use of that organ. Here, you never have the organ. Why would this be called sakana saver? If I don't answer the phone, then I'm not going to have the potential to then use it later on, but you never had it in the first place. So I thought it was a big chiddush. Last time Rav Asher Weiss was here, I discussed this with him. I asked him what he thought, and he said, "Nu, what did Rav Schechter say?" That's the way he starts every conversation. So I told him. So I said, my father thought it was pasha that it's a sakana saver. He said, "I agree with your father 99%. I disagree on one point." I said, "What's that?" He said, "I agree with the bottom line that it's sakana saver." And he was very excited about it because he said, this is a new category that we've never had before. A sakanas aver, that's really not a sakana if you don't have it. This was something, shaloshiarum avosenu, 100 years ago, who would have ever imagined such a case? But this is a fascinating category of halacha. So he said, I agree with the bottom line that it's called a sakanas aver and we would allow a Jew to do an issa derabanan in order to facilitate that on Shabbos. However, he said, the only thing I disagree with is that your father said it's pasha. It's not pasha. Let's take a minute to appreciate the Chiddush. That's a tremendous Chiddush. And it's applying all the principles of Shulchan Aruch and everything we know from other places to a modern day application, a fascinating case that could never have been imagined 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago for sure. So again, this is a very interesting case. So to say that this person would be then considered a Chola She'en Bo Sakana is a Chiddush, but it seems to be the case. And therefore we would allow violation of an Issa D'Rabbanan based on the Ramah's general principle, which is, when you're dealing with a Chola She'en Bo Sakana, not even on Shabbos, in general, we would allow that Chola She'en Bo Sakana to violate an Issa D'Rabbanan in order to be able to have what it is that they need. And this would fall under those guidelines and that category as well. Okay.